Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 16th episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kennyhurst. Today, I am joined by Dr. Matt.
Hi, my name is Matt, and I'm also a forensic anthropologist at the DPAA, working as a contractor. Mostly in forensic anthropology, I'm interested in how to develop the discipline in the Philippines and in the Asia region in general.
Nandar.
Hi, I'm Nanda Yuji, and I am currently a PhD candidate at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'm working on my dissertation, which is a biological distance study on a 20th century cemetery from Myanmar, which is where I am originally from. Currently interested in a lot of diversity and inclusion topic related research, and as well as representing more of that Southeast Asian region in the international sphere.
And
hi, my name is Elaine Chu. I am a graduating PhD student from the University of Nevada, Reno. My main research focuses are applying quantitative methods to growth and development of modern humans to explore modern human variation and population structure.
To discuss On Weird Anthropologists and Their Whites from Volume 4.
Could you briefly describe the article and give three main takeaways?
So we essentially, the article is a bibliometric survey. We looked at six journals, in total 793 articles across 5 years of publishing, to see who is publishing, essentially where they're from in terms of their author affiliations and what they're publishing on. And all this in order to understand where knowledge production is happening and who it's for. This article stemmed from two papers, actually, that explored the concept of the weird, which both describes this type of publishing mentality as well as describes an acronym. So WEIRD stands for Western Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And it was proposed by Joseph Henrich and colleagues. He, at the time, was out of the University of British Columbia. He's now at Harvard, where he looked at psychology publishing. And he found that most psychology papers were based on undergraduate populations as the study sample or experiment sample. And he found that their broad claims based on these populations actually didn't apply to majority of the world. They were very niche in their application. And so he described these undergraduate populations as weird because despite being a niche population that didn't explain a lot of what psychologists were seeing in other parts of the world, they became the archetype of what human behavior looks like. Fast forward to this paper by Kate Clancy and Jenny Davis out of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, where they extend this concept of weird populations in research to biological anthropology and how they defend that the acronym of weird is simply a euphemism for being white. Coming from European-derived or European-descended populations who hold positions of privilege in these weird contexts. And so we took those two ideas and wanted to see how it applies to forensic anthropology and how knowledge is produced within our discipline in terms of who is making that knowledge production and also who is benefiting from that knowledge, essentially our stakeholders, when we conduct our forensic anthropological services. So the main takeaways that I have are that most of the authors across those 793 articles that we looked at originate from weird contexts. Over almost 80% of all the papers come from weird contexts. And those papers receive more recognition. More than 3/4 of all the papers received most of the recognition in terms of citation, visibility, and citation number over non-weird authors and contexts. And looking at the sample specifically that these studies use and study, European samples are included most often in these studies, even in papers unrelated to ancestry. So over 69% of papers that don't even have to do with ancestry use European samples as their basis for making conclusions. We argue in the paper that this preponderance of European sampling reinforces a historic tendency to measure all human variation against one particular norm. And that's exactly what Henrich and colleagues originally in their evaluation of psychology tried to prove with their weird psychology concept.
So my take on it is that, again, it's very similar to Matt since we wrote the paper together. But again, this weirdness is just prevalent throughout these publications, right, that we see. So when we say weird, actually, we kind of are using this definition that Clancy and Davis that Matt mentioned earlier that they were using. It's kind of like a euphemism for whiteness. So that's kind of like the perspective that we're bringing in our article. When we say weird, it kind of basically means white and whiteness. And so we're bringing out this discrepancies between the publications, right, that we see versus from weird versus non-weird countries. And so that's something that we wanted to highlight. And so that would be kind of like my addition to what Matt just said earlier about my take on what our paper really means and what we want people to get out of our paper. Again, the first one is that weird countries, they really are the leading countries in the publications, right? In forensic anthropology. One of the reasons is also because the US itself is a leading country in forensic anthropology research, just because of how the disciplines are constructed across the world, basically. And like forensic anthropology just happens to be really big in the US. So the US also makes up a big portion of that weird papers and publications, right? And then the second one, again, is the sample that we use is when we're not even looking at population specific studies, or even when we're not looking at the bioprofile side of things, most of the samples that we're using are still weird. The last one that we wanted to also just that we want people to understand is that we're encouraging our weird scholars to be more reflexive and kind of like acknowledge who they are when they're doing research and when they're training anthropologists, or more like in forensic anthropology, because that's the scope of our paper, to kind of like acknowledge their privilege in a way and kind of understand their positionality a little more when they're doing research and kind of be aware of the effects that they might have and their worldviews might have on their research. So that would be the third takeaway.
Yeah, I think what really spurred this paper in general was just our desire to sort of put down in numbers what we as three BIPOC scholars were seeing in our own fields, and just acknowledging the fact that even at conferences or the papers we are reading in classes or who we are citing and whose methods we are learning from are all predominantly weird or white individuals. And I think that from that, it is not necessarily something that our field needs to be worried about our past. We cannot change our past, but we can acknowledge the whiteness of our field and how it is up to those who remain in the field to sort of find ways of acknowledging our privilege, being cognizant of how our own academic and personal upbringings affect the way that we think about our practice, about our research, about who is the classic archetype of a forensic anthropologist. I think all of those things were points that we were trying to highlight in our paper. And I think it's important to acknowledge the different perspectives in which can enhance the way that our fields can move forward. I think forensic anthropology is currently at this crossroads of a desire to want to do better and a desire to improve our methods, our practice, the way that we interact with stakeholders. And that all stems from diversifying our field, not only in the context of identities, but also perspectives. And that is one way that this paper really highlights how our perspectives so far have been driven by one particular weird context.
That was a great wrap up. And it's something that people probably won't, I mean, they don't think they'd ever consider. Well, when I say people, that's, I'm assuming people like me, other weird anthropologists that came through the system the same way I did. And you don't even challenge those ideas because you're not taught to. You're just taught this is the way that you do whatever, X, Y, or Z in anthropology. And you're like, oh, okay, I don't know any better. That's the way you do it. And it took way too long to be like, why are we doing things this way? This is really backwards. But it does seem like we are at this crossroads and we can stay on the road we are on, which is that Sisyphusian pushing that boulder up the hill that never ends. Or we can realize that what we're doing is fruitless and be better. So in thinking about that, it's been brought up a few times and how weird anthropologists could be better at acknowledging their privilege. What does that look like for someone like me to be able to do? And kind of like in a teaching situation, in a professional situation, in a publishing situation, how can weird anthropologists do this?
In the paper, we actually say in our conclusions that for weird white anthropologists, there's actually very little incentive to change the status quo. Because if you take advantage of your positionalities of white privilege, then you, as a weird anthropologist, will continue to secure funding, tenure, status recognition. So holding on to power is, in my mind, understandable. Like that's a natural human instinct to keep your position of comfort. What then, in our paper, we say, what then is the incentive for trying to diversify perspectives? And we argue that if you want to keep the discipline alive and relevant moving forward, then you need that diversity. So we recommend that acknowledging white privilege also requires even just knowing that your perspective is not universal. There are certain things that weird researchers, scholars, students don't even recognize as a problem that non-weird individuals go through when they're going up the ladder of forensic anthropology. For example, we talk about how international researchers and students require visas to attend these high impact conferences. And my personal situation coming from the Philippines, if you're a Filipino and you want to go to the United States and you just want a tourist visa, you have to show the US embassy your bank accounts, your land titles, all the wealth that you have in the Philippines so that the US government can say, okay, you're not a risk for overstaying your visa in the United States just to visit. And these are very, very small things that I feel weird scholars don't even know about, that these are struggles that non-weird researchers have to go through in order to achieve the same opportunities to succeed as weird scholars. So I feel like weird scholars have to not take for granted. They shouldn't assume right away that their situation, if they can do it, so can others, because the situation is not the same. That's, I think, a very, very small action or step that people can take, whether you're a student, whether you're a scholar, whether you're a practitioner, to have that open-mindedness and not jump to these conclusions that just because I could have done it, so could you.
Yeah, so to add to Matt's points, which are all really great points that I couldn't have come up with myself, because then I didn't have to go through the whole thing about the lens and the titles and all that stuff, right? So my perspective on what the weird anthropologists or scholars can do is to kind of understand that with these kinds of papers or the work that we're doing as BIPOC scholars, we're actually not calling anyone out. We want to call everyone in. So I think there's also a little bit of that intimidation in some weird scholars that think that, oh, I'm getting called out, or, you know, this is all my fault, you know, just like things and thoughts like that. That might not be as helpful when it comes to trying to understand what's next or trying to figure out what's next. So the first thing we want to say is, hey, let's sit down and figure this out together. And these are kind of our suggestions on what we can do, these actionable steps, right? Because we can't just critique and then not give you anything. So one of the problems that we identified in our paper, again, is the mentorship problem. The mentorship problem is kind of just that, for me personally, growing up, I never had a mentor who looked like me, right? So I actually found a mentor recently on my trip to Thailand for this international conference who actually looked like me. And I was like, wow, this is exciting. And it's she's a professor in CSU Northridge, I believe. And I was like, wow, another Asian professor who's doing really similar stuff that I'm doing. And so that got me really excited. And so not growing up, but just like, as I was going into this field, I was just like, I felt like a stranger most of the time. And I would think things like, oh, I can't really share this with my mentor or, you know, these people, because then I don't know if they'll understand what I'm going through. And I feel like I would be judged a lot. So like in terms of that mentorship problem or the steps to take for better mentorship, we kind of suggest this like intentional mentorship in terms of funding, training, or research opportunities, right? Students from BIPOC backgrounds or like non-weird backgrounds might not have the same experiences that weird students might have. So that's something that we would like to remind the weird scholars in mentorship positions as well, is that maybe you can think about things that you might have never thought about and kind of have conversations with your students who are from non-weird contexts, because then you can learn a lot more as well. And just offering support really means a lot to them as well, whether it's in terms of funding, training, again, or research opportunity. So that's my take on one thing that weird scholars can do.
I do think that there are institutions that are pushing for some mentorship opportunities. And so I think that especially stuff like AAFS is starting a mentorship program. And I think that that's something that weird, if we're talking about weird as in white scholars, can donate some of their time to just help. I personally have benefited greatly from individuals that I have just come in contact with who I have had the privilege to maintain contact with and be mentored by them in various ways. And I think that, Mike, your original question about how weird scholars and pointing to yourself and asking how to acknowledge your privilege, I think everybody could benefit from acknowledging their privilege, not just white individuals. If you take the original definition of weird as Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, I personally fit into all of those categories. I have very much so benefited off of my own privileges, even if my face or my appearance doesn't look that way. My mother is a professor. That already in and of itself gave me an extreme advantage in choosing a discipline that does still hold strong academic values and ties in our field. So I think that's one thing that we tried to do. Many people who might have read our paper might not be aware of that, but in our acknowledgments, we do a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek sort of acknowledgement to our own East Asian sort of privileges and perspectives that we have also benefit off of, because I think it's important to not only just say, hey, this one certain group of people, you need to do better, because we should all be doing better. And we should all be acknowledging how our own personal lived experiences can affect the way that we interact with other people and have different expectations for people. And so I think that applying that to forensic anthropology, it's all about acknowledging how your perspective may not match another individual's perspective, but to have charitable interpretations on their motives and why they are choosing a certain path or making certain decisions, and trying to come together in sort of a collaborative spirit to both move forward and improve our discipline as a whole, instead of a constant sort of head-to-head battle on which perspective is superior.
So going back to the whole topic about mentorship, right? I know a lot of people are limited on time, but kind of thinking about it this way, like if the mentors right now are training the next generation of mentors who are more diverse, then it can even spread even more. The diverse perspectives are going to be instilled in the future generations to come. And that was kind of like my whole point about, like, you know, when you're training someone who's from a diverse background or more like the non-weird background, you're kind of planting a seed for the next generations as well, in a way. And you're kind of like being more open and more nurturing towards that diverse perspectives that's to come.
What are some potential issues with basing such sweeping conclusions from such a niche, weird subset of data?
The main point is, and it goes back to the original weird article by Henrich, is that your conclusions from these niche populations may not, and most often do not, apply to the rest of the world. We always talk about, in forensic anthropology, population specificity, right? When we estimate stature, we always say best practice is to use a population-specific standard. But if you look at the general trends in how we publish, we don't apply that same logic to who we're studying and how we choose to apply it to. I already alluded before to the fact that in papers that don't even have anything to do with ancestry, European populations are the archetype, are the most common samples that are being used to generate these conclusions. And then we don't critically evaluate how those decisions in sampling affect how those methods are applied to samples that are not represented in these original studies. And so as forensic scientists, we should be very concerned with the applicability and appropriateness of our methods. And so having this perspective of maybe I should think twice about how my sample represents the situation I'm applying this to. Maybe if we think twice, then we can more fully justify and defend our opinions as forensic scientists.
So to add to that, like Matt said right now, currently the samples that are available to us right now are mostly weird, again, or white samples. And there are so many other populations that are underrepresented in our reference data. And so we can't just like take this standards made from white individuals and just place it on this other context and say, okay, yeah, this is going to be the stature of this person, because again, there's going to be human variation. You have to acknowledge that. And without diverse samples, there's no way to know that or study that diversity that we see in our human variation as well.
Yeah, I think non-diverse or homogenous samples create homogenous methods and conclusions. And so from that, what I mean is that if you were to take a common stature estimation method that was constructed using a white reference sample, and you have an individual who doesn't fit that context, they are more likely to be over or underestimated in their stature, but also excluded from a possible missing persons report that is at the actual missing persons report we're searching for. So that is the same sort of danger, or I guess disadvantage, of our discipline continuing to use the not only just white samples, but the same white samples that, you know, the Terry collection, the Hammond Todd, that also many scholars have noted are not applicable to our current contemporary forensic anthropology practices, the individuals that forensic anthropologists come in contact with. So continuing to just use these same samples because they are convenient, like Nandar said, or because they are what everyone else has done, again, following that same archetype of what has been done in the past. If we don't diversify our methods, our samples, then we don't keep up essentially with the reality of the forensic anthropology sphere, and even broader, the individuals that forensic scientists come in contact with.
I want to add also that going off of what Elaine was saying about a lack of diversity in sampling, we also in our paper focus on the authors, right? And there's a lack of diversity in thought. And so a consequence of having the same perspective doing the research means that the questions we ask, the methods we employ, the interpretations we make are all limited to one perspective. And so when we're trying to tackle issues in science by asking a question, testing a hypothesis, all these steps that we take for granted, in having a non-diverse pool of researchers, really limit ourselves in the approaches that we use to tackle these questions.
That's so antithetical to what we should be wanting, because we don't want just one interpretation of evidence, particularly when the questions don't have real answers, and we work in a lot of questions that don't have real answers. You need a variety of perspectives in order to make a good judgment, or any real informed judgment or anything. How do we encourage that better?
I'm all about open access. So yeah. I think, you know, I've been very fortunate to be very close to scholars and mentors who champion open access, not only to research, but also to samples and data. And so being able to not only get more diversified samples by using alternative techniques such as virtual anthropology to access a more diverse sample of skeletal information, it also means that we can diversify the perspectives who have access to that type of data, who might not be in weird contexts that have the same sort of resources or skeletal collections available to them. You know, Matthew did a great thing on starting a Filipino skeletal collection, but that is very rare. And so being able to have alternative sources of that data also allows non-word scholars to have not equal, but a better chance or a higher chance of being able to conduct the same sorts of research and apply their own perspectives to the data that in ways that we as people from weird contexts are not as privy to those sort of perspectives or approaches, because that's simply not our daily life or what we are thinking about.
Yeah, I agree. And I like to think of the world in terms of counterfactuals as opposed to things that I know. I see it this way, but I know that other interpretations exist and I want to know them because maybe that'll help me think of something else. So the real value is selfish, right? I get to be better. So I wish other people could see it that way, because it is such an opportunity to learn so much more, to get such a richer, deeper understanding of things you didn't even consider.
No, actually, Mike, I wouldn't really say that, because then when you are better and when you learn more things, then you can share what you learned from this type of research. And that way, other people can also learn from it. So inherently, I don't think it's selfish. Yeah. And I think that's how we want to approach this too, you know, like being more collaborative about how we move forward. And it's not like pointing fingers or anything. We're just saying, hey, how do we move forward together in a better way? And in a way, and this is kind of like a personal anecdote, or just like from my dissertation research, right? So the research population group that I'm looking at is from Myanmar. And right now there's a coup happening, so there's no way I can go back to Myanmar. So I somehow miraculously found a Burmese gold collection in Cambridge, which hasn't really been touched for 100 years. And so kind of like looking for these kinds of collections that you know can represent diversity a lot better, and being more cognizant of the fact that there are really old collections sitting in someone's museum collecting dust, and kind of going back to it and giving more, for me at least, I'm doing a move away from racial science, because the first study that was done on this collection, this Burmese collection, was racial science, because they're looking at, okay, like pure Burmese skulls, which is not possible. And so my whole focus is, okay, let's try to move away from that and give my own spin as a Burmese person myself. And I want to look at the biological distance, you know, something like that, kind of putting more efforts into trying to look for these kinds of collections that people might not know about might be another way to do it. And of course, like, I want to do the open access thing, but if I don't tell the world about this, then people won't know about it. So being better at kind of not, I don't want to say marketing, it sounds really weird, but like kind of publicizing that, okay, I have data that I want to share, then like maybe having a central place where people can look at. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, repository. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's exactly what I want to do for sure. And yeah, I think to your point too, in some of these collections that are harder to get to, even if someone has it and you can share that data, then you should, because what's the value of an idea not shared? There is none. We need to foster an environment in which we want people to hear our ideas and we want to hear theirs, right? It has to be two ways. You can't have it like, listen to me, but I won't listen to you. That's stupid. And that's not how you communicate. All right. So how does weird affect our objectivity?
I think I touched on this a little bit earlier, but we have to really question if science can be objective, because I feel like it is a human enterprise. And this, the way we do science, the scientific method, was something that was kind of handed down to us from Western European thought. And the fact that it is a tradition means that there is some steeping of subjectivity and cultural influence that does steer, you know, the questions we ask, the methods we employ. And as much as we aim to limit these biases in our analysis, how might other biases be otherwise introduced and then built into the questions we ask, our data sets, the variables we select, statistical modeling, and the like, you know? So we have this example in the paper about how subjectivity can creep in to what we otherwise think is an objective endeavor. So, for example, if we have to identify skeletal sex, we as an analyst might willfully avoid trying to learn about any gendered clothing or presumptive name association that comes with that decedent so that our sex is, quote, unbiased and objective. But how many of those sex estimation methods that we use consider non-weird or non-binary definitions of sex? How might we as practitioners consider the samples that were used to construct such sex estimation methods or the communities in which, you know, these methods are applied to? So what is lost in the identification potential of this person and the process when non-weird knowledge or perspectives are ignored? So thinking about that, can we still say that our endeavor is objective?
I also think that, of course, when we say objective science, it's in quotation marks. We can't really, again, take anything as objective because we're all human. And I know there are a lot of research or like more current research done on this within Forensic Anthropology too, with I think Elaine and Amar, I think, did a and colleagues did a presentation about this at AFS last year. I believe our friend Shaughnessy Clemens and Alicia Winburn, they publish on these, you know, topics about objectivity, what really it is. And people are saying, you know, the myth of objectivity. And I really agree with that because, again, what are facts, quote unquote facts, based on, right? And they're all based on standards made by people who are dominant in the past, right? Like in science, what even counts as objective science is determined by old white people, if that makes sense. I don't know how else to put it. But again, it's that weird perspectives are playing into this idea of objectivity that we're trying to hold on to it. Of course, there are standards that we have to follow in when we do science, because there are rules there, but then, you know, it's not hard and fast. Like there is definitely going to be subjectivity in our quote unquote objectivity.
And yeah, because regardless of whatever it is we can measure, we still have to interpret it. And a lot of times we interpret things based off of numerical values that we might not completely understand. So are we really making informed judgments?
No, I think I echo what both Matt and Nandar have said. Is essentially the idea of objectivity is a fallacy in and of itself, especially because anthropology is the study of humans and it is the study of humans conducted by humans. So there is no way that we can be as objective as, say, toxicology can be in the raw root number of a blood alcohol level. Our interpretations and our results are always steeped in not only the subjectivity of ourselves in making that interpretation, but also the subjectivity of the creator of the methods or the models or whatever we are using to come to those results and conclusions. So it can never, for us as forensic anthropologists, really be truly an objective endeavor in the same way that other forensic science disciplines are held to that standard, just because that's just not a possibility in our field. And I think that it's okay to acknowledge that and sort of think about ways in which we can make our interpretations as objective as possible, like our example with not looking at personal effects prior to our analyses, but also that acknowledging that including the availability of personal effects may help not necessarily in something like sex estimation, but could help in a missing persons report where an individual may not have identified with their sex assigned at birth. So I think that it's important. What might make forensic anthropology stand out is the fact that we are not able to be completely objective. And that might be because of our weird, mainly weird perspectives and upbringing as a discipline, but also because we are allowing for non-standard approaches and ways of thinking right now. And that is also, I think, a really beautiful thing for us to continue to explore.
It's funny that you bring up toxicology, Elaine, because if we measure blood alcohol level from person to person, we can get this quote unquote objective number, but we know that how a person reacts to that inebriation is different, right? So, you know, law enforcement, legal proceedings have established a hard number that is either below legal or above illegal. But in reality, that number doesn't affect the same person the same time each way. Someone can be completely functional at a higher blood level, or someone could be completely, you know, incapacitated at a lower level. So there again, like, okay, we have this objective number, but how it applies from person to person and how we enforce it is completely subjective.
Matt, to your point, I would say we can look at p-values the same way. 0.05 has no power, and it only means one thing if you actually say the exact assumption of the question you're asking in context of the test. And everyone just thinks that, yeah, a number has power. But again, it's a mechanical decision that someone, and in this case, again, an old white guy, Ronald Fisher, said 0.05 is your beta. And people are like, yep, that sounds good. Then I don't have to think about it. Then I don't even care what that number is actually telling me because it's significant now. But it's not.
I think the problem also lies in that people like to label things as objective, but then there is such subjectivity in there without acknowledging that subjectivity. And then it, like, for generations, it goes on and then it becomes this quote unquote objective thing without many people questioning it. Maybe until now, like right now, right, this generation is like, okay, hey, let's take a pause and look at what exactly we're doing, what kind of science we're doing, and what are the effects of it. And I think that's the really the important part about doing this reflexive activities that we're doing, like we're doing right now, is that taking a pause and say, wait a minute, maybe let's revisit that. I think that's the importance of the research that we're doing and also going to be doing in the future, instead of just labeling everything as objective. Hey, let's acknowledge that there is subjectivity in there. Acknowledging there are limitations in our research is also another thing that we can do to improve the field as well. I think also another thing about science and these kinds of objectivity related topics, or, you know, how the public perceives science in a way, is that they think science is 100%, but it's not. And when we acknowledge that it's not, then they doubt science. So that's this whole thing that we as anthropologists and also just scientists in general should be better about, is that communicating that little phenomenon that we have with the public. You know, we're not saying that we're not, oh, like, we're not sure, like, question mark, but it's just, no, this is what we're presenting, and this is the accuracy rate or whatever we're presenting, all these stats. But then how the public takes it might be a different whole other story, right? So that's something that I think a lot of scientists still struggle with, is communication with the public about what we do and why it matters what we do.
Yeah, I think it's hard to talk about. It's hard for people to talk about their research in ways, because we get so caught up in the specific terminology and way you talk and think about it, or not talk about it, right? Most people only talk about their research once or twice a year at conferences, and that's really it, right? Unless you're a student and that's, you have an advisor and you're always getting feedback with research. But after you're out of school, that's essentially gone, unless you're super engaged in some level. But usually we don't talk about it, particularly anthropologists. I don't know how we can be better about doing that, but it is hard to talk about our research in a way that might make sense to somebody without so much pretext or context or setup or whatever.
As anthropologists, we are like swimming up a current also in terms of like public discourse, because I feel like the knowledge that the general public has about certain topics in anthropology were perpetuated by anthropologists, you know, a generation ago. So like when we talk about, you know, the biological fallacy of race, for example, where do you think the general public got their idea that races exist? From anthropologists. So in one sense, it makes our job a lot harder. And in another sense, it also makes our job that more necessary, that it's our responsibility to correct those incorrect assumptions that people have because we told them that this is the way that it is, like, you know, 50 years ago.
How does weird fit into our current understanding of race and ancestry?
I guess I can kind of like go off of what Matt said earlier about how we are swimming upstream or up current with what we're doing right now. It's kind of like patching up the holes that previous anthropologists from generations ago have created. It's like, okay, let's try to patch this up. No, that's not what we're trying to say, or at least they were trying to say that in the past, but like, no, it's science has evolved. Like we have, you know, or I think one of the most difficult parts about our job is patching that up while also doing our own research, is like balancing those two things. And so public understanding of race and ancestry is so different from what we do. And trying to explain that human variation doesn't always mean biological, quote unquote, biological race, which doesn't even exist. And so that disconnect that we see in between the scientists or like anthropologists and also the public. The question was more about the current understanding of race and ancestry in field, maybe. So that's another whole other story about like what we understand as anthropologists and then what the public understands. So there's like so many different things that we need to string together in a way. So it is kind of difficult.
In our paper, we describe how race and ancestry, even the concept of race, ancestry, or if you want to call it like population affinity, is a weird conceptualization. The framing of race as, you know, biological categories is historically from European thought and, you know, the European Enlightenment. And so we say in our paper that, you know, like all cultures across the world kind of have their folk taxonomies of the origin of mankind and our place in the universe. But our modern conception of what race is stems from the weird perspective. And so we are trying to estimate this perspective in our forensic anthropological practice without necessarily questioning why we have chosen this perspective in the first place to be our ground truth. So I feel like it behooves us to critically analyze, like, what actually are we estimating? And people are having these conversations, what we're estimating and why we're estimating it, and its utility in a modern forensic context where we know that weird powers, weird perspectives are the major driving force behind our actions.
Going off of that, weird contexts or the practice of population affinity estimation itself stems from colonization, but also globalization. So I can think of many places in the world that is not the United States or maybe South Africa where forensic anthropologists do not estimate population affinity or anything of that sort, race or ancestry, and however you want to categorize it. And it both is due to more homogenized population or population in terms of the people who live there versus places like the United States that have this huge amount of variation in which potentially estimating something like population affinity will assist in the identification of a missing person. So our current understanding of these sort of concepts and why they may or may not be important in forensic anthropology also stems from the fact that we have this weird upbringing in our society that created these divisions, but also created the space for diversity because weird individuals were not originally, for example, here in the United States. And so those sort of things that add that diversity that also force us to, maybe not force us, but has been a natural progression on how we as humans categorize other individuals, is also steeped in sort of a weird origin story, I guess.
So yeah, I think a lot of us who are trained as forensic anthropologists, right, when I was in my master's program and when I was starting to learn about forensic anthropology, and back then we called ancestry estimation, we didn't even know what it was. And we were like, okay, let's try to do that. This kind of training is trickled down from earlier notions from weird contexts, right? From weird scholars who said that, hey, let's do this. And if you trace back the history all the way up to how biological distance studies happened, it was all race and racial science, racialization that was going on. Again, I bring up my dissertation again, because back then in the 1920s, Carl Pearson asked for purely Burman skulls, which doesn't even make sense or doesn't, you know, really, it's not feasible to have quote unquote pure population that he's trying to get at. So the motivations behind these early studies were obviously racist in nature, but then that kind of just got trickled down over the years. And we talk about how the term race has really evolved into ancestry, or the term had changed, but when we do this kind of estimation, we still are using very similar methods and things like that, you know, and now it's population affinity. So just by changing the name doesn't really change our perspectives from weird contexts that have been taught through generations, but more it's that we need to start looking at the theories that are behind it that we're trying to push, like with population affinity, right? What are we trying to push? Are we trying to move away from race and ancestry? So that's something to make a real difference in how we think, these are the questions that we should be asking. And so the weirdness really just persists through generations of academia. And so now we're trying to dismantle that.
Could you please briefly describe how you conducted your survey? And can you specifically explain the H index and what that means and how to use it for other people that might be interested in conducting similar surveys?
We did our survey manually, which was very difficult. I'm sure someone out there has an automated way to do it. We chose 6 journals that we felt were the most relevant to forensic anthropology, use their advanced search tool to use search terms like forensic anthropology, in order to gain all the articles in those journals in the past 5 years that had to do with forensic anthropology. We recorded who the authors were, their primary affiliations, and input those articles into Google Scholar to get the citation numbers, and then amassed essentially this large database of English language journal articles. So we didn't look at foreign language journal articles, and we explain the pitfalls, but also the necessity of doing that in the paper. And then we also acknowledge the limitation of that. And we give a shout out to this archaeologist. Her name is Laura Heath Stout out of Boston University, who did a similar study, but about archaeology. And she actually sent out manual surveys to all of the authors in order to glean their positionality. So she sent out 5,645 authors surveys across 21 journals across 10 years of publishing. And we were like, wow, that's amazing. We're not doing that. But in our paper, we say, you know, if we had the drive to do that, that's the way to go. That's the way to imitate. So a limitation of our methodology is also that we have a very large assumption of the positionality of these authors, because we're only basing it off of their country of affiliation. So when we give you these numbers, like how much percentage of papers come from weird contexts, etc., that has a big caveat in terms of it's also kind of sort of capturing people who don't have weird positionalities but are working in weird contexts. In terms of the H index, it's essentially a measure of productivity and citation impact that accounts for a balance between the number of publications you produce, but also how many times those publications are cited individually. It was a metric that this physicist, Jorge Hirsch, came up with. He's out of UC San Diego. He came out with this index in 2005 in order to understand the productivity of theoretical physicists. And it's a very simple calculation. Essentially, what you're looking at is how many publications do you have that have at least that same number of citations. So, for example, if I have 18 publications, but only 9 of them have at least 9 citations each, then my H index is 9. And that's the index that's also used in Google Scholar. If you look at the individual author's profile, it will report that H index. So we extended that metric to countries instead of authors. So in our study, all countries had at least an H index of 1, meaning that no country in our sample received 0 citations. The fact that we listed that country means that we found a paper with an author from that country. And the fact that every country has at least an H index of 1 means that every paper was cited at least once per country. So we use actually total citation count, number of articles, and H index in our paper to measure, you know, citation practices. The H index was used as a balance because you could have you could be very, very productive in your article count, but if no one reads them, then it's quantity over quality. And then you could also not be publishing at all, except you publish this one article that is maybe, let's say, a widely used method that would be cited, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. So that's quality over quantity. So the H index is an attempt to merge those two.
I guess another thing about H index is that it can change over time, right? So we conducted our study, like we wrote the date that we kind of like gave this hard stop is 12 September 2020. So up until that day, we're taking that snapshot. But of course, like, more citations can be made. And so that's something that we want to put it out there. It's that H indices are not hard and fast, can change all the time. And so that's why for our purposes, we're making sure that we acknowledge that that date that we're, you know, making that hard stop. And so, again, acknowledging that part is very important, I think, to understand this, why we use H-index and basically the utility of that in our article.
One thing I forgot to mention about H-index is only applicable to, like, if you specify the time frame and you specify the discipline, because H indices vary widely between, let's say, English and theoretical physics. So when you set the parameters to be similar amongst each other, then it becomes comparable. So that's just something that you have to keep in mind if you're ever applying the index.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's a really good caveat to keep in mind. Otherwise, you're going to get super crazy erroneous data you can't make sense of, I would imagine. All right. So what were the major findings?
Essentially, most authors among all the papers we studied come from weird contexts. The top four countries that produce the literature in forensic anthropology are the US, followed by Italy, the United Kingdom, and France. And among 56 countries that we evaluated, those top four constitute like 7% of all the countries that we evaluated. And yet their studies contributed to more than 50% of all the articles. So, you know, 52 countries are half of the articles, and then these four countries are the other half. So there's really a large disparity. And overall, weird contexts receive more than three quarters of all the citations, whether you look at it by total citation count or by H index. So they receive the most recognition. So these other non-weird articles are being ignored. So that's in terms of who is doing knowledge production. In terms of who is knowledge production benefiting or who is it for, we find that European samples are the most represented. Whether you're going to explicitly include them because it's a paper on ancestry estimation, or whether they don't necessarily have to be European for your research topic, in papers unrelated to ancestry, they are still by far the most represented in forensic anthropology. So again, we argue that the fact that they are overrepresented reifies this concept of weird populations becoming the archetype for broad claims about human variation.
I agree, though, too. And I think that's something that people don't even realize, though. They might, in their article or something, like, say, and even though this was only done on a European-derived sample or whatever, it should be explored in other populations. That's something you should have considered from the get-go. Look towards other populations before doing this. Even though you say it needs to be tested, no one listens past that first thing. No one goes and chases that down because they already added that tool. And now they're like, all right, that's the way the world is. My base rate is now this. So they might not even be aware that that's the way they're structuring it, but it puts it at a detriment. And it's like a waste of your own time as the researcher, because if you do find out this is just some sample bias weird thing, then you wasted a bunch of time telling the world it wasn't.
Yeah, I think it also kind of shows a lot about the field in general. It's like, oh, this person's using it. Let's use it. So it's like a kind of quote-unquote viral thing. I don't know if that's even like this viral method and used in forensic anthropology. So it's kind of like encouraging us to also critically think about the methods that we use and really go into that primary research paper that says it and really read it so you can determine whether you can actually use it on this population sample that you have or that you want to use in. So critical thinking, I think it should be a little more just like driven into us during our like training years, maybe. I don't know. It's just like as a early career scholar, sometimes I would be more prone to, you know, just follow whatever my mentor says or whatever other people are doing. So maybe take a step back and say, hey, what is it that I'm reading? How can it be applied? And, you know, just is it weird context or not? You know, like thinking about those things would really help advance our research in the field also.
I'll just reiterate what my co-authors have said. But I do think that the sheer prevalence of weird articles and also higher H index values, meaning also potentially more citations, just highlights a little bit about how academia in general is a sort of popularity contest. And you know, we all come from our certain academic lineages and backgrounds on whose methods are also taught to us and what methods we are most likely to come in contact with. And that also then perpetuates greater citations of certain methods and certain authors because they have been established as high quality researchers producing high quality publications. And so then you are again more likely to trust their work over others. And that also is steeped in some weird concepts. If we are not reading papers from non-weird contexts, we are not coming in contact with amazing researchers outside of our own personal context. And that means that we are also not learning from those individuals, and we're not perpetuating, might not be the right word, but sharing and distributing their work further and encouraging others to also look outside of those top four countries, because those are the ones that are publishing in these English language journals that are then further perpetuating where we should be getting our information from. And I think that is the major takeaway is, you know, looking at our first figure on single authored publications are very prevalent in very Western contexts and weird contexts, but it doesn't, you see more non-weird contexts when we start adding co-authors and second and last authorship. And that also just means that they are less likely to be recognized, these non-weird researchers, and therefore their contributions are less likely to be appreciated as well.
I also wanted to add a little bit on, you know, this discrepancy that we're seeing. But I learned recently that there are some countries that when they give grants to these PIs, there is some kind of like stipulation or like some requirement that the PI has to be the first author on like certain papers or something like that. And so I was like, well, that's not fair. I mean, it's institutionally, or like the system itself is very biased in a way, I guess. Like it really determines who gets to be first author and not. And so maybe as PIs or co-PIs, maybe we can start speaking up against that. And so that's something that I see as still a problem. You know, it's like, oh, it's required that you have to be the first author. Well, what about my colleagues who are doing the same work that I am? I just happen to be better at English, you know, or something like that. It's like, if the only difference is English versus not English, then there's no difference. Like they are more than capable of doing it. And so kind of driving that, or just like addressing those kinds of systemic problems, I think is also as important as making our own decisions as, oh, who gets to be first author or not.
Nander's example of, you know, like, PIs being mandated by their institution to be like first author or something is something that doesn't necessarily happen in the US, which speaks again to the fact that, you know, our specific situation is not universal. Like how we were talking about, you know, how weird researchers don't even know the hoops that non-weird scholars have to go through to get visas to attend conferences, even just tourist visas. In the Philippines, for example, and in many other Asian countries, universities will give you a little bonus in your salary if you publish. And that bonus depends on your author position and also the impact factor of those journals. And some universities even have a list of journals that will be awarded bonuses and journals that don't count. And these types of upholding of, you know, status are, I feel like, things that these institutions are doing, one, because they inherited it from, let's say, colonial mentality, that, you know, they were told that these are the important journals. If you publish in these local ones, we're not going to pay attention. And two, also comes from the fact that these non-weird contexts are trying to compete with these weird contexts. And they think that they're encouraging their employees to shoot for these higher impact journals. Because if you publish in a local journal, you're going to be ignored. So this is our way of incentivizing you to keep up with, let's say, the US in this example. Whereas you as a US researcher, you don't even care, right? But we talk about this in the paper, how some US researchers, well, okay, let's say weird context researchers value being first author versus, let's say, second. And so they will go into a country, use all of the country's resources and the people in order to navigate that country, and then think of themselves as deserving of the first author because they think they did all the work, when in fact that work would have been impossible without the local people in that country helping you out. And so they want to keep they feel like they deserve that first author position. And maybe they do, which is fine. But do you have the empathy, for example, to acknowledge that this first authorship position for you means way less in terms of trying to survive in the context you're earning a living in versus giving that first authorship to the local person whose livelihood depends on that position? Have you used any outward thinking and empathy to acknowledge the power you hold in being the one who's submitting that manuscript? You know, to have that foresight and to have that sympathy.
And another point to add is that you can write so many papers on the same research that you do. So maybe share that space a little, you know, I don't know. That's something also to think about, because you don't have to only write one paper. You can write so many papers. And so just think about, again, dividing and conquering, kind of like that. It's something that we can think about.
Where does the desire to be first author and be visible come from? So that's where we're saying, like, these are decisions that you're making, and yet you say that your research is objective. These are active decisions that you're making, that you want that recognition, which feels good. Like, I understand, like, you want that recognition. You feel like you have to make your place in the world. But also, so do your co-authors who might not have the same privilege to stand up for themselves and say, like, wait a minute. Maybe, you know, I did this too, which made the work entirely possible. Like, have you considered me? Some people come from contexts where they're not at a place or privilege to express that, right? And so responsibility to acknowledge these limitations falls on the person with the most privilege, I feel like.
Yeah, and I think that the concept of publish or perish is a weird concept in academia that has now been distributed across the world to all of academia, right? We know that because of Matt's example of bonuses based on publication in high impact journals. But the stake or the ramifications for publish or perish may differ based on context, right? So first author publications in a lot of US academic institutions means higher likelihood of promotion in those kinds of counting, but also publications in general count. And they are not tied to bonuses in the same way as in the Philippines. And so I think it is a really clear example of traditional, potentially archaic ideas of what success means in academia, of which forensic anthropology is still very much deeply steeped inside of, that are affecting the ways in which we recognize and acknowledge who is a main player in our field and who deserves that recognition at the same time. So I think that's where in the United States, it's very much a personal sort of prestige-driven desire to be a first author, because that is what we've been told makes you an authority in the field. Whereas in other contexts, it's very much about, sure, that prestige is nice, but also I would like to be able to feed my family and live. And I think that those, that the context, right, like that is completely different, but it's all steeped in this publish or perish in academia sort of mentality that originally stems from weird ideologies.
I want to circle back to Matt's last point about the privileged person should be the one that acknowledges this position. And I agree, because the person that might be needing this for the bonus, whatever, what a terrible position in terms of decision-making power to have to ask that, right? You need it, you have to ask, but you're also worried that this might lock you out of future opportunities in a very real way. That's such a really gross power dynamic for someone to be in and to not even be aware that they're there. And just acting like, oh, it's no big deal, but I'm still first author. Just brushing it off without even having to consider what that might actually mean. Were there any results you found surprising or unexpected? We kind of touched on some major things, but was there anything just kind of that you were like, oh, I didn't expect to see that? Just anything interesting from your points of view?
I would say that no, none of these were surprising to us, I think. I guess that's like coming from a very honest point of view, because these are kind of our lived experiences and the things that we know about. And we wanted to just put it in more concrete evidence and give you, you know, the numbers, so to speak, to say that, look, this is the real experiences of BIP or non-weird scholars or people who are in the local country, or I guess like the countries that we might be going into do research in. These are the lived experiences of these kinds of scholars. So it's more just like giving more evidence with our bibliometric study. And so, yeah, we don't think anything came as a surprise.
I think we even say in the paper, none of this is surprising for the people who actually live this. I think we have a sentence in there that says, it's not surprising, and yet we are embarking on this endeavor to put it into a journal article because the people with privilege only listen if it's in a journal article. And
yeah, because we love to defer to authority.
Exactly. We need to have to be able to cite something in order for it to be true. And I think we do call people out on that in the article.
Yeah, I think what really happened was none of us were surprised, but we're hoping that other people are surprised when they read it, right? I think that we're hoping that these figures and the raw numbers are what drive people to think about it more. And I hope that it convinces other people to read our discussion and take a more reflexive approach and think about ways in which each individual, each reader can help improve or might improve in the future how forensic anthropology works. I think that's the goal. Is personally, it might not have been surprising or unexpected in any of our results, which is kind of sad, but also hopefully eye-opening to others for which this might have been a very surprising outcome.
We talked about this a little bit at the top, but how do we get better as a field? Both steps an individual can make and like an organization can make, right? Like what are the steps, big and small, that we can take or should take to get better?
I feel like everything we suggest in our discussion has been suggested previously by others. And the fact that we have to repeat ourselves means that there hasn't been any traction in that regard. In terms of institutions, it's that publisher perish mentality is perpetuated, I think, by the system at large. And maybe that's not the best way to measure the success of a person. And we go in depth into the myth of a meritocracy. And if you, as a person in a position of privilege, you know, read our discussion and acknowledge that people have different chances of success, all other variables being equal, then that's already a very, very healthy first step into acknowledging that you being aware of the struggles that someone else has to go through, that you didn't have to go through, does not detract from your own success. Does that make sense? Like, don't be afraid to acknowledge that someone was in a position through no fault of their own, that they couldn't achieve this certain thing. That doesn't mean that acknowledging it somehow belittles your own achievements. I feel like some people are afraid or hesitant to think that way because they want to cling to the fact that they felt like they worked hard too. And you did work hard. But when you, for example, review two CVs as a hiring manager and see that one person didn't get this award or didn't attend or present at this conference versus another CV that did, is your initial instinct to say that that person is not good enough or was not good enough to get an abstract accepted? Or was it a completely different reason because of their non-weird positionality that prevented them from adding that line to their CV? So if you can step outside of this knee-jerk reaction to somehow objectively measure people based on your on what you think, oh, they should have been able to do this, then I think we can start to see progress in allowing more opportunities for people.
To reiterate what Matt was saying too, is that hard work versus privilege, right? Just because we say someone is privileged doesn't mean that we're saying that this person didn't work hard. They, of course, may have worked hard, but like the non-privileged person might have worked hard in their own ways as well, in ways that this privileged person might not even think about. So that's say again, like, we're not taking away anything. We're saying it's okay to think about it in both ways. Privilege, hard work, they can both exist.
I think just having that space, thinking slower instead of having those knee-jerk reactions, considering why you might have a knee-jerk reaction. You know, the length of the CV is also distinctly steeped in our weird ideals of meritocracy and what it means to be successful, and to base someone else's entire opportunity or chance at getting a position or being accepted into a graduate program, having certain opportunities, very much so de-weirdifies our field. It's a huge barrier. It's a huge barrier, and it's a huge leaky pipeline to allowing for space for more non-weird scholars. And so I think that a great first step is just taking that time to think about why your reactions or your privilege may be harming someone else, even if it's not with malicious intent or even explicit in the way that you're doing it. If it's completely implicit, you're just a product of how your own academic and personal upbringing, but it is also on each individual to acknowledge that and try to do better.
Yeah, to realize that maybe free choice does exist only if you're willing to question why you do things. Other than that, it doesn't, because then you're just a program creature responding to stimuli unchecked. There's a lot important in this paper that we talked about. Is there any other detail about this that you think might get missed?
While we have reiterated consistently other people's ideas on how to improve the diversity in our field, I think that it's also important for listeners to also know that our field is getting better. We are not saying that it is the same as it was 50 years ago. We just were able to witness an invited symposium at AAFS that was entirely comprised of BIPOC early career scholars and students. And the fact that we could even create that sort of space is entirely because we are making steps and hopefully successful in retaining those individuals and making our space less weird. So I think that that's, and less white. And I think that that is important to also know, is that while we are definitely acknowledging that weird perspectives are pervasive, it doesn't mean that the field is not moving forward and that it is a place to also avoid or, you know, discount or write off because of our weird past. It's important for us to also forge ahead and be able to take the opportunity to introduce new perspectives and new people into the field. That's super important.
For people reading the paper, something not to miss is maybe our acknowledgments. people who read papers often skip that part. And I think that was our way of putting a little more personal touch into the motivations for starting this paper. And for people who share similar positionalities for us, they might see that they themselves feel that same way. And then for people who don't share our positionalities, I hope that you understand our perspective better and can find value in what we're trying to say as people of color to essentially people without color.
I will just add one thing, I guess, is that all three of us, again, this is kind of related to the acknowledgement section and also like our positionalities, acknowledging our positionalities. We are more like US trained scholars. So that definitely shapes how we say things or how we look at things. And so I've actually, and this is like a shameless plug, but I actually did a similar study on a smaller scale on Southeast Asian archaeology to present at a conference in Thailand that I went to last month. And it's very interesting how at this international conference, how different people react to my presentation as opposed to when I presented this weird paper presentation at AVS. It was very different. And that's something that I have been learning these few years, is that depending on which audience you're targeting, you might get different reactions and different feedback, for example. And so that's something that we want to also acknowledge, because again, US trained scholars with our backgrounds like that, of course, our worldviews are going to be shaped by our educational background. So when I was presenting this other paper at an international conference, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I hope I don't offend anyone. And I managed to offend some people. And I was like, well, I guess mission accomplished. Oh, well, but something that I have been more aware of these days is that I sometimes like to say that we're in our little American bubble, American anthropology bubble, and it's a real thing. And so stepping outside of that also helps get like another perspective on what we say, how we say it, and how people might take it.
Thank you so much to Matt, Nandar, and Elaine for such a thoughtful discussion, and thank you for listening. We'll be taking a little bit of a break as we line up the next series of interviews. Until then, be good.